It's time now for World Watchers International with Mae Brussel, who for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's Mae.
Good evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's broadcast number 546, and it's May the 23rd, 1982. There are so many articles of interest in the news just gushing out in the past few weeks and months, but four in particular caught my eye that pertain to information that I've had on the air for the last few years, many years, on KLRB, and are now coming to a head in the Battle of the Falklands. One was Jack Anderson's article this week, Falkland Questions: Could an obscure war over some barren islands in the South Atlantic erupt into a major Holocaust? Would the United States become embroiled? These questions hang like Antarctic storm clouds over the Falkland Islands. And he goes into the sophisticated weaponry that could be used that's available both to the Argentinians and to the British and, of course, to other nations, and asks the question, is this going to become something much larger, these clouds overhanging the Falklands at this time? The next article was a continuation of the CBS report last week on 60 Minutes about the importation of Nazis into this country. And they elaborated a little more. Not only did the State Department bring them into this country and destroy the records of their being here, but they were trained for specific hit squads to murder and to perform political assassinations and to start civil wars behind the Iron Curtains. Now, the weapon war and the Antarctic space satellite war, the area in Falklands and Antarctica for the satellite stations, has been a project I've mentioned many times, or originating with the book Project Paperclip, that brought the Nazi war scientists into the United States and down to South America and down to the Antarctic region for military purposes the minute that World War II was over. And this story of the hit squads is typical of the research that I've had, that the exiles from various countries, such as the anti-Castro Cubans, the white Russian Solidarists, were all involved in the assassination of John Kennedy, that we bring these people over from other countries and train them specifically to go back, whether it's in Hungary or Poland or Russia or Cuba, start civil wars, have civil unrest, even if there was a revolution that kicked them out. These were the corrupt people. These were the mafia types, the goon squads, the killers over there. The Southeast Asians we brought over, the CIA, the dangerous ones, the killers. And we are making them security guards in this country and training them to kill and then go back to Southeast Asia. And some of them can be very useful in this country. So, again, we didn't just give them a safe haven away from the Soviet Union. We didn't incorporate their expertise into our universities and into the hospitals or schools or even some of the military, but trained them for hit squads, for political assassinations, to send them back to other countries to be murderers, which is very much part of the literature coming out of Galen's Spy of the Century and the use of the Galen Agency, Hitler's chief of intelligence, and the Eastern Division, who was then brought to the United States and has trained these assassins all over the world. Another article, Air Shuttle's War Role Revealed. Now, that great space shuttle that everybody watched taking off and landing the first three flights is now going to be converted to national defense and military uses, and the space shuttle will now be routine after the fourth flight for the Defense Department. And an Air Force Lieutenant Colonel this week, Mr. Hartsfield, said the shuttle is a national asset. The military can derive a great benefit from it. And, of course, the military use of space is what the purpose was in bringing scientists here, to have these terrible kind of wars with lasers and beams that could burn people on sight down on Earth, select a particular home or human being and instigate fires or large areas. Another article in the paper this morning, San Francisco Chronicle, from the Knight News Service, U.S. fears the fighting will spread across South America. And before Ronald Reagan took oath of office and before, while he was running for election, before he was even elected, I was trying to illustrate that if you get Ronald Reagan, you get World War III, that he was the selected leader and that the entire Washington, D.C. establishment is set for World War III, and Alexander Haig would love to be riding on that horseback as commander-in-chief. He's supposed to be antagonizing the South Americans by favoring Great Britain, but the White House this week entertained the president of Brazil, and the United States can send all the weaponry to Brazil that will supply Argentina. There is a wheeling dealing here, and I wouldn't trust Alexander Haig any more than Prince Bernhard, who was in the SS, Hitler's stormtroopers, and representative IG Farben, and then during the war in the Netherlands becomes a representative of the Dutch resistance. What we're getting here is a man who's played the dirty end of this war battle scene, never wanting peace, never making peace. Wherever he goes, there's war. And this story of our fear, we fear the war will spread. We have encouraged it to spread, and that is the thing that this administration would have and love and would have war powers. Ronald Reagan would love to have war powers. Whenever I lectured at various universities, when I was traveling around at those universities, or people write to me for a bibliography on how to study the political assassinations in the country, I have three references that are number one, two, and three before you get into any of the details of who killed John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King. And one was always Project Paperclip by Clarence Lansby of the importation of Nazi specialists into the United States. There were 642 Nazi specialists, but they were sent all over the world and down to South America and Argentina and settled in this country and moved around. And if you don't understand the role of these particular people disguised as scientists, some were and some weren't, they were war criminals, you can't understand what happened to America. The other book, of course, is the Cookeridge book, Galen, Spy of the Century. There's many good books about Reinhard Galen. In fact, one that he wrote himself is a lot of information. But when he gets $200 million from the CIA to form assassination teams, hit squads, working with Otto Skorzeny and all his top Nazis from Hitler's regime, and he comes to the United States and goes right with the OSS and forms the CIA, what we had really is the selling out of the United States to that Gestapo. And, of course, next were my three articles that I listed that give an overview of the American assassins, how Nixon came to power, and the transfer of power in this country to Galen and to Himmler's SS. And if the news of today is about space wars, World War III, the advanced technology that's down there in that area that has not yet been used but can be used, the origin of understanding all this goes back to these books that have been available for a long, long time. In Project Paperclip, just in the beginning of the book, it tells how the Joint Chief of Staff first had an objective called Overcast in July of 1945. Now, keep in mind that the war was over in April, or winding down April, May the 8th, 1945. So by July 45, they were going to bring in 350, in quotes, chosen rare minds to increase our war-making capacity against Japan and aid post-war military research. You have 2 months after the war, you have May 8th. By July, they had arranged a project called Overcast, chosen rare minds to increase the war-making capacity of the United States. The war has been over 2 months, and aid post-war military research. And in the spring of 1946, the State Department, the Navy, the War Department had a military program which was called Paperclip, where the quota was 1,000 specialists, and they transferred their family to the United States and made them immediately offer them citizenship. And according to Project Paperclip, they had a denial value in military terms. Nobody really knew who they were. They were called scientists. And it was decided that the national interest would be the immigration of these people, these specialists, for employment into civilian industries and nonprofit institutions of learning and research. It was right after the war, when the OSS was going with Wild Bill Donovan, that Elmer Bobst, the man behind Pepsi-Cola and Richard Nixon and the Nazi war criminal Otto von Bolschwing, got interested in the American Cancer Society and worked with members of the OSS and took over the American Cancer Society. So these renowned Germans, approximately 50 preeminent specialists immediately, and then thousands later came with their families into the United States of America and actually infected us and brought with us, to us, the fascism that they were doing all over Europe and brought it to American soil. And if you don't understand this process, you can't understand today's inflation or bank robbery or the missing millions of money or the high interest rates keeping wars going and the way this country is getting polluted and falling down with jobs, housing, and provisions for the elderly and so forth. It was the importation of these people that they had worked as specialists in Germany from the end of World War I to World War II, some of them, and brought here within days after World War II was over. Now, I referred several weeks ago to a book, Assault on Eternity, about Admiral Byrd down in Antarctic area when the war was over and when these Nazis were brought here. And a listener to World Watchers obtained this book for me at the library this week. And I want to just give you a few more quotations from that book in addition to mentioning the review of the book. It's called Assault on Eternity by Lyle Rose, published by the Naval Institute Press in 1980. And chapter 13 is called Eternity Restored. The purely military benefits of high jump, Operation High Jump, was Admiral Byrd down in Antarctica, 1946-47, when the Nazis were moving down to Argentina and Antarctica. The military benefits of high jump were more impressive to the admirals, seemed even more impressive to the admirals. As a naval cold weather exercise, there was inestimable value down there. They got a real insight into problems you have to risk in the polar regions. In this rapidly shrinking world, which I mentioned last week, Admiral Byrd had the following plan for the Arctic polar region, the basin, because the short route between eastern and western hemispheres, and it was important to strategic area and battleground in any future major conflict. Now, this was decided in 1946 for us that the battleground down there would proceed. And then the book goes on, in choosing to emphasize national security aspects of Operation High Jump with Admiral Byrd and to subordinate scientific interest and inquiry to the military needs. They're going to subordinate it. Byrd and Mr. Cruzan placed the operation in Antarctica firmly within a temperamental program framework, and it was similar to the Manhattan Project during World War II in secrecy. It would culminate in the space race in the late 50s and 60s. Operation High Jump was the first post-war effort to melt science and military in a partnership that would protect or enhance national security. This was the first post-war effort. Within days of the war, they were deciding that our science and our military would have a partnership. Now, this went into hospitals. This went into prisons. This goes into the high rate of cancer. One out of almost every five people is having cancer today, into chemicals, into food, into fertilizer, to the acid rain that is coming down and so forth, the employment where people are getting cancers, the testing of bombs. The military and the science made their first post-war effort down in this area to enhance national security. Now, it's a tragedy that they define for us what is security. When did the admirals get the brains? When did they get the philosophical background to determine how we are secure? Are we secure today because they loused up this world from World War I up to the present day? Are we secure with what they did to the schools, the medium, the television, the movies, the educational system, the trash that's thrown at us, the health system? They had to determine for us national security. No thanks. I think the military should be removed from all these decisions and civilians put in the decision. This book, Assault on Eternity, said in the wartime Manhattan Project, and that was the atomic bomb, which produced the atomic bomb, as in High Jump, the Antarctic area, the latter deep freeze expeditions to Antarctica and the space program or so forth, they had the same objective and commitment. They In other words, what went on down in Antarctica was the same objective, only using space, as the Manhattan Project had, of using atomic bombs and dropped with airplanes over Japan. This time, the objective was the same, but take it up a little higher. Their goal, as they perceived or defined it, was that we have to understand how to operate in polar climates, which they did, and how to most effectively prosecute the next war. How to effect the next war? Well, thank you very much. But who decided that the next war would begin in 1945 and 46? I know who decided it. A man who wrote a book called The Secret Surrender, Alan Dulles, decided. There's another book on the subject, Operation Sunrise, that I'm going into. But I'm talking about treason of the highest level now. There's a book that came out by Howard Watson Ambruster called Treason's Peace, P-E-A-C-E. And it's the story of I.G. Farben and the German dies and American dupes, it's called. This book came out in 1947. Well, we had already been duped before the war was over, because I have spent maybe 10 to 12 hours a day going through books and fingering the dates from 1943 to 45, when America was agreed upon and sold out to the Gestapo, to Adolf Hitler, who planned a very clever stalling of time in a specific area known as the Battle of the Bulge, which I am going to define for you from a very interesting book, many books I'm reading, but I call the objects or the articles I'm talking on now treason's pieces, because there were pieces of the treason and America was sold out. So by 1946 and 47, when Admiral Byrd went down to Antarctica, these people already had a place. They were planning, in this book, Assault on Eternity, on Eternity. It says they were planning the next war. Is there any better title than this book, Assault on Eternity, that describes the plans for World War III of the type that we're going into, decided before the other war was over, or even Alan Dulles' own book, The Secret Surrender, which he did. They gave this country away. They didn't have to, but they planned the next war. And according to this author, Lyle Rose, we had to invest vast sums and energy in South Polar research to derive as much benefit and prestige as they did, whoever they was, to get to the moon before anybody else. They had the manpower. They had the massive application of money and technology. I was reading a book another listener to World Watchers got for me on the South. It's called The Poles, and this is on Antarctica and the South Pole. And this shows atomic energy being brought in 1961. I mentioned last week or the week before they had it in 1968, but atomic energy was down there in 1961. Now, when did the selling of America take place? I believe there was a specific date of treason. I think it happened with Herbert Hoover. I've mentioned this before. Nothing is more clear than the deal that he made to give our tax money to the Poles, the Russians that moved into Poland at the end of World War One. The book, The Great Conspiracy Against Russia, is known among some researchers. Some of you listeners are not familiar with it. It's by Michael Sayers and Albert Kahn. And, of course, I might ask the riddle or the question, what president of the United States owned $1 billion in Tsarist Russia? And the answer is Herbert Hoover. $1 billion in oil, in minerals, in forests, and the timber and so forth. This was in the Tsarist Russia, and when the communists came in, he was livid. The president, the future president of the United States that brought us down to that depression, had $1 billion in Tsarist Russia, and there's a quotation in the book, The Great Conspiracy, Bolshevism, said Herbert Hoover at the Paris Peace Conference, is worse than war. In this book, The Great Conspiracy, it goes into the details of funding a huge amount of money that was meant for the poor. He was supposed to be the great knight that fed the poor with the famine after World War One. In this book, it says Herbert Hoover placed millions of dollars worth of American relief supplies at the disposal of the Poles. On January the 4th, 1921, Senator James Reed of Missouri charged on the floor of the Senate that $40 million that Congress had allocated for relief funds was spent to form the Polish army in the field, and much of the money raised in the United States for relief was given to these people to fight the Soviets that were now in power. Hoover made it clear in his report to Congress January 1921 that he accepted $100 million for the relief, and the report showed that almost all of it, $94 million that was accounted for, went immediately to the White Russian armies and Allied interventionists who tried to stop the Soviets from taking the $1 billion of investment away from Herbert Hoover, who became Secretary of Commerce and then President of the United States, and then formed the Hoover Commission in 1947 to reorganize the Constitution and the federal government without having a constitutional convention. Now, as I say, Alan Dulles, in his book, Operate the Secret Surrender, describes how he was meeting in April of 1945 and earlier. The war was over in May the 8th, 1945, but he was meeting continuously during the war in Bern, Switzerland, with members of the SS, Hitler's SS, and with members of his organization and Donovan's, known as the OSS. And Stalin got wind of the fact that they were trying to make a deal with Great Britain to move the other part of the world and attack the Soviet Union, who had been our ally, instead of settling the war the way it did turn out. So Stalin was wiring Franklin Roosevelt, you know, what are you going to do? In this book, it says April the 3rd, Stalin answered Roosevelt's message, and he was furious. Among other items in Stalin's piece, there's a claim that the Germans had agreed to open up the front to English and American troops and let them move to the east, while Britain and Americans exchanged the possibility of easing the armistice terms for the Germans. Now, Franklin Roosevelt answered Stalin on April the 5th, and they had a correspondence going until April the 12th, and Roosevelt had assured him he wasn't doing that. And April the 12th, the day of the last message, was the day that Franklin Roosevelt died. And the secret surrender didn't go through officially. The Russians did move into half of Germany and got that far. But what Hitler did and the SS was to take all of his intelligence and his Gestapo men from the Russian front and move them to the west so that they could be brought immediately to the United States when the war was over. Now, this was a pretty good trick, and the Battle of the Bulge is something I had never studied until recently. I don't like war stories, I don't like war movies and war games, but it became a necessity to delve into this area because there were too many people of importance in power today that were sitting there at the Battle of the Bulge when it was taking place. Specifically, there was that Fritz Kramer, who the German of I.G. Farben, whose family were in Nazi Germany, who had an American uniform and recruited Henry Kissinger. There was Dwight Eisenhower, who delayed the Battle of the Bulge, and his reward was to become President of the United States. He prolonged the battle so Patton could get in there and not Montgomery and end the war 7 months earlier. There was Richard Nixon, who was working with the Nazis and making deals on Navy intelligence, whose reward was to become President of the United States, and if he couldn't win it in elections in 1960, his opponent could be killed by an outfit of the Galen people through Clay Shaw, Martin Bormann, and the Galen Permandex operation throughout Europe, and that made Richard Nixon president. William Casey is director of the CIA. He was there involved in the Battle of the Bulge, and at the time of the secret surrender was making deals with Nazis and organized crime and the mafia in Sicily, and that's when we really got sold out. And Senator Joe McCarthy, who was wheeling and dealing and is mentioned in some books, if I have time, I'll give you quotations. He came to power by releasing some Nazis in Germany who played the major part in the Battle of the Bulge. And Henry Kissinger came on to be Secretary of State and Director of the National Security Council. And Fritz Kramer, who brought Kissinger to the Bulge area, went on to be Plan's officer for the Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army and could still be there today. And Otto Skorzeny, who put the Germans into American uniforms and practiced that for 2 years to form the worldwide Odessa, not only released Mussolini for Adolf Hitler, but got himself out of jail and a lot of top Nazis also. And William Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan of the OSS, was involved with this battle, and Prince Bernhard, the notorious Bernhard who married Queen Juliana of the Netherlands. The book Queen Juliana that was given to me by one of my World Watcher friends and loyal listeners, in the introduction of this book, it says that when Juliana was to marry Bernhard, it brought violent protests in Holland. Buildings were firebombed. Students fought with the police. Members of the parliament discussed whether the monarchy had outlived its usefulness, because Bernhard, before being the head of the Dutch resistance, was a part of the Hitler Youth and the notorious SS. He later turns out to become the leader of the Bilderbergers, that annual meeting of secret top people all over the world who make decisions on every country, major country, whether there'll be coups or murders and how they will rape them of their resources. And he was involved in 1976 accepting $1 million from Lockheed, which he didn't need. But he was part of the, when the Nazis were occupying the Netherlands, he was supposed to be member of the Dutch resistance with his background. And people that set up the Bilderbergers, the director of the CIA, the head of the plans, it right now in Washington, what I'm doing is taking every character that I find in these books who was involved in that battle, and I'm trying to show where they are today and how important that was. Now, there's a book that came out called Hitler's Last Gamble, The Battle of the Bulge, published in 1967. This was a French book translated and published in New York, Schocken Books, S-C-H-O-C-K-E-N. And I'll be referring to this book many, many times on this broadcast in the future, and I might have in the past. But in the foreword, the author says that he got the idea for this book, the Ardennes Offensive, A-R-D-E-N-N-E-S, that's the area where the bulge was, and he thought the true story should be told. He said the siege of Bastogne in that area during World War II was a famous story because the Allies lost 80,000 men. Yet the Ardennes Offensive is better known to the Americans than the Battle of the Bulge. And he goes on to say the landing in North Africa by the Allies is written up many times, and also the invasion of Normandy, June the 6th, 1944. But the author of this book says there is no comparison to any of these events, whether the African or the Asian conflicts or anything. There is no comparison to the Battle of the Bulge because of this reason. While the battle in Ardennes gets more attention because 80,000 men died, and there were not that many in the Bulge, it still is an area that's been overlooked. The author says it's, nevertheless, even though it's been overlooked, its political repercussions, both on Germany and on the Allied side, were greater than those of any single operation in the war, the political repercussions. Now, I mentioned Senator Joe McCarthy, who released the two top Nazis that were absolutely known war criminals, murdering and pillaging the Eastern Division and also American soldiers in this area. Senator Joe McCarthy's role was to turn Americans against America with the Cold War, with the suspicions, with the House committees, and get people fired and blacklisted, suspected communists under every rock. The Bilderbergers was the international organization. Casey became the director of the CIA. He's the head there now. Kissinger is the ambassador at large, and everyone involved in that dirty affair is running our life today. So therefore, it's necessary to go back to the place where they were all sitting at the time that American soldiers were being killed. They were all in that little enclave, and it was that enclave that delayed the end of the war until Hitler could get $300 million worth of art out of the area, $200 million worth of gold from a salt mine, millions of dollars into Swiss banks, some to Argentina, billions of dollars. And they needed that extra time to get their SS people prepared and the Project Paperclip people prepared to come into this country and down to Antarctica. And that's why it is such an important area. This author says its political repercussions on Germany and the Allies was greater than any single operation of the war. The military events, in the strict sense of the word, only became of interest when viewed against the background of the general strategy in the autumn of 1944. The military events are only important when you see the strategy, and it is the strategy that I'm studying. And I'm studying it now, and it isn't apart from the Falkland news, because Falkland is inches from Argentina and Antarctica. And the recipients of this technology, of these assassination teams, of the Condor assassins down in Argentina, in Chile, in Colonia Dignidad, the techniques for sending assassins all over the world for the last 40 years, was a project allowed because the battle was stalled till they could get out. And this article says that there were things going on here with the Allied side. They were reticent to move and be strong, and the Germans had a plan in 1944. And it's that plan that is working today that is so important that I'm studying in terms of the past murders and assassinations and the future World War III that they determined in 1946 and wrote about. We'll take a 1-minute break and then do some more on this subject.